So Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Leela, chapter 14, texts 63 and 64. So I'll just chant through text 63 and then we'll do 64 together. Seeing Lakshmi Devi, the Lord became attached to her. And Lakshmi, upon seeing the Lord, felt great satisfaction within her mind. Text 64. Translation, their natural love for one another awakened, and although it was covered by childhood emotions, it became apparent that they were mutually attracted. Purport. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lakshmi Devi are eternal husband and wife. Therefore, it was quite natural for their dormant love to awaken when they saw one another. Their natural feelings were immediately awakened by their meeting. So three sentence purport. So how is he going to pull this off? Well, it's sort of cheating in a way. I'm going to talk a lot about Rukmini this morning because it's a great story. How Krishna came to marry Rukmini. It's full of drama. And Prabhupada also made a specific contribution to the pastime that's not, you won't find anywhere in the Acharya's writings, as far as I'm aware. So I'll be speaking a little bit about Rukmini. But before that, a little bit more about this meeting between Lakshmi and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this personality, Vanamali Acharya, was a matchmaker in Navadvip. And he approached Sachi Devi and he asked her, why aren't you thinking about arranging your son's marriage? This is coming from the Chaitanya Bhagavat. So he is described in the Gauragonadesh Deepika as the matchmaker Sri Vishvamitra, who arranged the marriage of Sri Ramachandra and who was the Brahmana messenger that Rukmini sent to Keshava. So he appeared as Vanamali Acharya. So this matchmaker was no, as usual, no ordinary person. He was actually the same one who arranged the marriage of Ramachandra. And he was the messenger that Rukmini sent to Krishna when she was about to be forcibly married to Rukmi. Sorry, to Shishupal. Sorry. Rukmi was her brother. And it was due to his influence because he was very inclined to Shishupal. And if, as a matter of fact, there was a whole group of people that were very inimical in their attitude towards Krishna. Very inimical. So much so that he was more or less forcing his father's hand. King Bhishmaka, the father of Rukmini, was a great king, very pious king, and he was very favorably inclined to have to let her accept Krishna as her husband. But her brother was had a great influence on the father. His father was very attached to Rukmi. So by the influence of Rukmi, the marriage had been arranged between Shishupal and Rukmini. So, anyway, back to this, back to Lord Chaitanya. Maharaj. Back to Lord Chaitanya. So he was asking Sachi, why haven't you arranged the marriage of your son? And there was a person, Vallabhacharya. He said, there's a great exalted personality, not the same Vallabhacharya, a different Vallabhacharya from Navadvip. And he had a daughter named Lakshmi. He said, he has a daughter whose beauty, qualities, and temperament are as good as Lakshmi. If you wish, I will arrange their marriage. So Mother Sachi replied, my son is fatherless. Leave him alone to study for some time. Later, I will consider it. So the Brahmana wasn't very happy with Sachi's reply because he thought he had the perfect arrangement. So in disappointment, he left. But on the way, he met Lord Chaitanya, Gaurachandra. And Lord Chaitanya immediately, upon seeing him, embraced him. And he said, "Tell me, where have you been?" And he said, "Well, I've just been speaking with your mother. I offered her a proposal for your marriage, but for some reason I don't understand, she refused." So when Lord Chaitanya heard this, he became silent. And then he smiled, and he spoke a little bit more with the Brahmana before returning home. So when he got home, he asked his mother, "Why didn't you respect the Brahmana's proposal?" So Mother Sachi was very pleased when her son spoke like this because it kind of gave her an indication what his desire was. So then she called that Brahmin back to her home. And she said, "Oh, Brahmin, I've decided that you may immediately arrange what you proposed yesterday." So this Brahmin took the dust from Mother Sachi's feet and immediately left for the house of Vallabhacharya. So then the whole thing came about. Vallabhacharya arranged the marriage. There was a very gorgeous ceremony, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was married to the beautiful goddess Lakshmi. So now, in terms of the pastimes of Krishna, I did a little bit of research as usual because, you know, my memory's bad, so I have to write things down. So some interesting things. As you know, when the idea of Rukmini getting married was put forward, there were a lot of kings that wanted to marry her. She was extremely beautiful. And her father was a very powerful king, very opulent. So many stepped forward hoping that they could win her hand. And Prabhupada summarizes in the third canto, he says, "Princess Rukmini, the daughter of King Bhishmaka, was actually as attractive as fortune itself." It's almost like a play on words. She's the goddess of fortune. So he says she was as attractive as fortune itself, because she was as valuable as gold, both in color and in value. Since the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, is the property of the Supreme Lord, Rukmini was actually meant for Lord Krishna, but Shishupal was selected as her bridegroom by Rukmini's elder brother, although King Bhishmaka wanted his daughter to be married to Krishna. So, again, this is you often find this in various pastimes where someone is overly swayed by sentiment. So in this case, King Bhishmaka was very much influenced by his son, Rukmi. Rukmi wanted his sister to marry his friend, and they were all had inimical feelings toward Krishna. So even though it was against her will, Rukmini had never actually seen Krishna. She had never seen him, but she had a desire to marry him. Now, why? Because she had heard in the assembly of her father, various sages had come through and spoken about the glories of Krishna. So just by hearing about him, she became completely attracted. His feelings were awakened. And she wanted to marry him. She had her heart set on it. So she was in quite a lot of distress. The Prabhupada writes in the, there's a summary, let's put it this way, in the 10th canto where it says, "But although Rukmini's other relatives approved of her marriage to Krishna, her brother Rukmi was envious of the Lord and thus forbade her to marry him." So he was actually forbidding the marriage. He went completely against her desire and insisted on his way. And the father was swayed by his affection for his son. So It says Rukmini unhappily took up her duties in preparation for the marriage, but she also sent a trustworthy Brahmin to Krishna with a letter. So, so when the Brahmin appeared in Dwarka, Krishna asked him, "Well, you know, why have you come?" And he explained that he had this letter from Rukmini. And so Krishna, he had the messenger read the letter to him. And it was a very tremendous outpouring of feeling, which concluded in this way. It says, "Ever since I have heard about you, my Lord, I have become completely attracted to you. Without fail, please come before my marriage to Shishupal and take me away. In accordance with family custom, on the day before my marriage, I will visit the temple of Goddess Ambika. That would be the best opportunity for you to appear and easily kidnap me." So if you think about it, this is quite a bold proposal. I mean, Rukmini was no pushover. She was a Kshatriya princess. She wasn't afraid of much of anything. And although she knew she was going against the wishes of her family, she sent this letter and proposed. You know, it's a pretty bold thing. You propose to somebody, "Look, I want you to come kidnap me, okay?" So you can just imagine, she was no, I don't know what you want to call it, some kind of simpering. You know how in a lot of these old films, you have some heroine that's just crying and lamenting about her situation and expecting somebody to come in and swoop her away. You know, hoping for it, but not going so far as to actually send a letter and not only request, but more or less. Well, she used emotional blackmail. In the letter, she said, you know, we frown upon emotional blackmail these days, but Rukmini didn't seem to have too many qualms about it. She basically said, "Look, I love you more than anything in the world, and if you don't come and kidnap me, I'm just going to give up my life by fasting and observing vows, severe vows, and maybe in my next life I will be able to attain you." She actually wrote this in the letter. Basically, "I'm going to kill myself if you don't come and kidnap me," which I think is fantastic. Anyway, doesn't matter what I think, but so when Parikshit heard some preliminary things about this marriage, this particular pastime, he makes this statement, and you have to try to understand Parikshit's mood. He's sort of subtly, you know, he's sort of encouraging Shukadev Goswami in the way he expresses this. He says, "The Supreme Lord married Rukmini, the beautiful-faced daughter of Bhishmaka, in the Rakshasa style, or so I have heard." So he says it like, "I heard this." So he's really, by expressing it like that, he's really encouraging Shukadev Goswami to tell him the whole story. Now, Rakshasa style, as I'm sure many of you know, is a little unusual. It means that someone basically does what Rukmini suggested, which is to kidnap her and carry her off. And if anybody tries to interfere, you have to fight with everybody to make it happen, and then you make that person your bride. These days, that probably wouldn't go down too well, possibly, depending on the mood of the woman involved and how tough the man is. But generally speaking, no, that's not considered acceptable anymore. But at that time, this was considered an acceptable form of marriage, if you could pull it off. Well, she knew very well that if anybody can pull it off, it's Krishna, because he was, you know, her all in all. She was Rukmini is a direct expansion of the goddess of fortune. So you can just imagine that it was suspected that Krishna might try to do something. So all these kings like Shishupal, Shalva, Jarasandha, there was a whole retinue of kings that, you know, wanted to interfere with anything that Krishna might try to do. There's a verse from the 10th canto in which Jiva Goswami makes some comments on that are quite interesting. The verse is the 18th verse of chapter 52, 10th canto. It says, O hero among the Kurus, the Supreme Lord himself, Govinda, married Bhishmaka's daughter, Vaidarbhi, who was a direct expansion of the goddess of fortune. The Lord did this by her desire. And in the process, he beat down Shalva and other kings who took Shishupala's side. Indeed, as everyone watched, Sri Krishna took Rukmini, just as Garuda boldly stole nectar from the demigods. Purport, Srila Jiva Goswami gives the following profound comments on these two verses. The words Shriyo Matram indicate that beautiful Rukmini is a direct expansion of the eternal goddess of fortune. Therefore, she is worthy to be the bride of the personality of Godhead. As stated in the Brahma Sanghita, Shriyak Kanta Kanta Paramapurushaha. In the spiritual world, all the female lovers are goddesses of fortune, and the male lover is the Supreme Personality. Thus, Srila Jiva Goswami explains, Srimati Rukmini Devi is a plenary portion of Srimati Radharani. So she's an expansion of Srimati Radharani. The Kartika Mahatmya section of the Padma Purana states, Kaishore Gopa Kanyasta Yovane Raja Kanyaka. In childhood, Sri Krishna enjoyed with the daughters of cowherd men, and in his adolescence, he enjoyed with the daughters of kings. Similarly, in the Skanda Purana, we find this statement, Rukmini Dwarak Vatyam Tu Radha Vrindavane Vane. Rukmini is in Dwarka, what Radha is in the forest of Vrindavan. The term Swayamvare here means by one's own choice, although the word often refers to a formal Vedic ceremony in which an aristocratic girl may select her own husband. What is that called, anybody? What is it, when does that happen? Yeah, that she selects her own husband. Swayamvara ceremony. So that's the usual application of this term, by one's own choice. Isn't it? I mean, usually that's the way it's done, or it was often done, that she could make her own choice. So in this case, that wasn't possible. It says, although the word often refers to a formal Vedic ceremony in which an aristocratic girl may select her own husband, here it indicates the informal and indeed unprecedented events surrounding Krishna's marriage to Rukmini. In fact, Sri Krishna and Srimati Rukmini chose each other because of their eternal transcendental love. So this choice was, in other words, more or less inevitable. They are eternally connected. So how is there possibility that anything else would take place? So this king, this Bhishmaka, was the ruler of the kingdom of Vidarbha. And he had five sons and one daughter. And it describes when, after, so it's described that after Krishna had heard this letter from Rukmini making her plea to be kidnapped, the Lord replied and he said, I am indeed attracted to Rukmini, and I know of her brother Rukmini's opposition to my marrying her. Therefore, I must kidnap her after crushing all the low-class kings. So he referred to those inimical kings as low-class. Just as one might generate fire from wood by friction. So the Krishna's definitely in the Kshatriya mood here, you can see by his language. And these vows of marriage are supposed to take place within 3 days. So Lord Krishna ordered Daruka, get my chariot ready. And he immediately set out for Vidarbha, which he reached after one night's travel. I remember years ago, we did a calculation. from where Krishna was in Dwarka to Vidarbha, the kingdom of Bhishmaka, it was a tremendous distance, and yet he covered it in one night. But he had an edge because he had transcendental horses. So he was able to make this journey in a single night at tremendous, almost unimaginable speed. He covered the ground. So this King Bhishmaka was kind of caught between the sentiment for his son and the sentiment for his daughter. He was not very happy about having to do what he was supposed to do as the father. He didn't really want her to marry Shishupal. He didn't particularly like Shishupal. But he felt pressure, and so he made very gorgeous arrangements for receiving all the kings. And the enemies of Krishna had prepared battle plans in case Krishna tried to interfere in any way. And Balaram, when he heard about all these plans, he got together his own army and followed behind Krishna with a tremendous army composed from the members of the Yadu dynasty. So he was ready. And they were ready for a fight. It says he went quickly to Kudinapur. I don't know Kudinapur, whether that's just a place. I think it's a village or town nearby. So the night before the wedding, Rukmini was in a lot of anxiety because the messenger had not yet returned. So she was in high anxiety. And she was going through all these different speculations about, well, maybe Krishna has decided that I'm, for some reason, that I'm disgusting. You know, I've offended Lord Shiva. Or maybe possibly, she was going through a whole catalog of all the people she might have offended that Krishna wasn't going to come and rescue her. So she was getting almost to the mood of, kind of a mood of helplessness. So, finally the messenger appeared and he told her it's okay. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. He told her it's okay. He's here. Krishna had already arrived at the precincts of the city. He'd been greeted actually by Bhishmaka, the king, been offered various kinds of facilities. When the kings used to have guests in those days, the level of hospitality was extraordinary. They would not only would they house them in opulent quarters, they would worship them in various ways. They would offer them, you know, food stuff and see to all their comforts very elaborately. So he had received Krishna and Balaram like that. But this was kind of like, you can just imagine, this was confirmation. This was confirmation that Krishna and Balaram were here and they are up to something. So for the other kings, they were, as they say, girding their loins. They were getting ready for a fight, and they were fired up, as we say. So, so how did it take place? So she felt completely confident. So she went to visit the temple. Rukmini went to visit the temple of Ambika. And she says she proceeded there surrounded by many guards. After bowing down to the deity, Rukmini prayed to be allowed to have Sri Krishna as her husband. Then she took the hand of a girlfriend and left the Ambika temple. Seeing her inexpressible beauty, the great heroes present dropped their weapons and fell to the ground unconscious. Now this is a pretty, you know, she must have been pretty good looking because, you know, that people drop their weapons. I mean, these are tough guys. I mean, tough men, kshatriyas. They dropped their weapons, and many of them actually fainted just by seeing her. And she was, says, Rukmini walked with deliberate steps until she noticed Krishna. Then, as everyone looked on, Sri Krishna took Rukmini onto his chariot. Like a lion claiming his rightful share from a band of jackals, he drove back all the opposing kings and slowly made his exit, followed by his associates, Jarasandha, and other kings, unable to bear the defeat and dishonor, loudly condemned themselves, declaring that this defamation was like a petty animal stealing away what rightfully belongs to the lion. So Krishna actually was the lion, of course, and he was taking her according to her desire. But they were thinking that they were the lions and he was a petty animal being allowed to get away with something disgusting. So they became became furious. Now, when we in Dallas many years ago, Prabhupada was visiting, and in the evenings we would sit out in this little garden near the temple, and he would And that I was always happy at certain times not to be one of the big devotees, because oftentimes he would just point to one of his senior men and say, "Speak," and then they had to hold forth under Prabhupada's scrutiny. And so at those times like that, I felt really relieved not to be one of them. But anyway, so he was having them read from the Krishna book, and as I remember, I think it was Brahmananda that was reading. And when we got to this point where Krishna kidnaps Rukmini, puts her on his chariot, and it starts to drive away, Prabhupada suddenly sat forward like this, and his eyes got really big. And I remember he made this motion like he was holding the reins, and he said, and she was driving the chariot, he said, like this. She was a Kshatriya's daughter, he said. She was no weak woman. So in other words, she was actually, while Krishna was fighting off these armies, she was driving the chariot. So he became so, like his eyes got so big when he said this, and it was almost like he was visualizing it, and then he made the motion as though he was driving the chariot. So I thought, because we used to read the Krishna book stories all the time to the students, and I thought, I don't remember anything like that in the Krishna book. And then even years later, I looked it up in the Bhagavatam, and I couldn't find any reference to Rukmini driving the chariot, nor was it in the Krishna book. So this appears to be a very visionary experience that Prabhupada was seeing enacted before him as the story was being read. And this is often the case. I mean, I remember in New Vrindavan also, and a Janmashtami celebration, the program was that everyone was seated in the temple, and Prabhupada asked the devotees to read from Krishna book. So they started with the first chapter, and they read through the first chapter. Then they read through the second chapter. And then they started into the third chapter. And at that time, people had been fasting all day. It was quite late at night. And you see saw these devotees kind of like dipping forward as they were nodding out. And even after a while, some of them were like falling backwards and banging their heads against the temple walls. And all the dandas were dipping and everybody was just kind of really going unconscious right there. And Prabhupada was oblivious. Well, when I say oblivious, I don't mean the way we're oblivious. He was absorbed in the pastime so much that he didn't really notice that people were falling asleep and nodding out all over the room. And I remember at one point when someone made a particularly loud crashing sound by falling against the wall, Prabhupada looked up and he a little surprised, and he said, "Oh," he said, "you are tired." So then he said, then he stopped it and he said, "Take prasadam," which we were very happy at the time to hear. Not having a whole lot of taste, I guess that was the problem. But anyway, he had taste. So when the armies attacked, back to the narrative, when the armies attacked, there are arrows flying everywhere, and Rukmini looked to Krishna. She was feeling a little bit fearful that such a violent onslaught of weapons was coming their way, and it says that Krishna laughed, and he said, he assured her, "Do not be afraid, beautiful-eyed one. This enemy force is about to be destroyed by your soldiers." Well, in the purport and also from the commentaries of the acharyas, it describes that this was his way of expressing his affection for Rukmini by gallantly referring to the Yadava army as "your men." Because by marrying her, the whole kingdom became hers. So he was in that way expressing, "These are your men. Don't worry. They're going to take care of everything." And Prabhupada writes I mean, not to Prabhupada, I guess it's Sri Ananda Maharaj and Gopi Jana, Gopi Pranadana. I don't know which one of them wrote it. I suspect it's Sri Ananda Maharaj because of the way the purport is worded. But it's a nice one, and I wanted to read it. He says, I'm reading the first part again. To express his great affection for Rukmini, Lord Krishna gallantly referred to his own Yadava army as your men, indicating that the Lord's entire dynasty was now the property of his beloved queen. The Supreme Lord Krishna desires to share his blissful opulences with all living beings, and thus he sincerely invites them to come back home, back to Godhead. The Krishna consciousness movement, introduced throughout the world by Srila Prabhupada on the order of his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who himself preached all over India on the order of his exalted father, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, is broadcasting the loving message of Lord Krishna. Remember him, serve him, return to him, and share in the infinite bounty of the kingdom of God. So, I just thought that was nicely put, that this was the business of the acharyas in our line, especially beginning with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who, as you know, revived the Krishna consciousness movement. It had fallen into some obscurity. And then his son took it all over India, reached out to various places in Europe, although they didn't have so much success there. And then Prabhupada came and took it around the world. So, so there was this tremendous fight. And of course, the pursuing armies were all destroyed. And Jarasandha, in trying to comfort Rukmi, was telling him, well, look, I fought Krishna 17 times and I only beat him once. So he claimed to have beaten him once. He said, but so you just have to accept that, you know, whatever happens, it's by the divine will. So all the kings pretty much, after getting thoroughly defeated, I mean, there were a lot of bodies strewn all over the field. But Rukmi and Shishupal sort of gave up. But Rukmi was so angry that he was determined to do something about it. So he pursued Krishna with his own army. And he was shouting all these wild insults. He was so embarrassed that these arrangements that he'd tried to make for his sister hadn't come about. So it says he was practically dying of shame. And so he pursued Krishna, uttered all these challenges, which are described as ridiculous in various places. I mean, he was saying that Krishna had no... was like an animal taking away his sister, and so many insulting words. So all the weapons that he hurled at Krishna were just shattered into pieces. And finally, he was captured by Krishna. He was bound, and Krishna started shaving different parts of his hair and beard, making him look like ridiculous. And so at this point, when Balaram showed up, he saw the condition of Rukmi, and he felt sort of sorry for Rukmi. So he released him. He released Rukmi and spoke to Krishna. He said, "My dear Krishna, you have acted inappropriately." He began to preach to Krishna, and he began to preach to Rukmini in a sort of an interesting way. But he was the elder brother, so he had the right to chastise a little bit. And he was kind of doing it on behalf of, but it was very clever the way he did this. He sort of chastised Krishna slightly for treating a family member like this. But at the same time, he was preaching to Rukmini, like, why are you acting as though you're on the bodily platform? This person may be your brother by family connection, but he's a rascal. Why should you feel sorry for him? So I just thought this speech of Balaram is particularly interesting, and I was going to read it and comment a little bit on it. So first he accuses Krishna of not behaving properly. This deed will bring shame on us, for it is to disfigure a close relative by shaving off his mustache and hair is as good as killing him. Saintly lady, please do not be displeased with us out of anxiety for your brother's disfigurement. Sorry. It's just funny to describe somebody as disfigured just because their hair and beard is a little odd. But anyway, no one but oneself is responsible for one's joy and grief. For a man experiences the result of his own deed, in his own deeds. He experiences the result of his own deeds. So he's saying whatever's happening to him, it's because of his own behavior. So there's no point in you getting so upset. He's brought it on himself. Then again, he's addressing Krishna. Turns the conversation back to Krishna, and he says, a relative should not be killed, even if his wrongdoing warrants capital punishment. Now, the irony of this is that later on, it was Balaram that kills Rukmi when they were having this gambling match where the king of Kalinga kept showing his teeth to Balaram. Balaram wasn't apparently a good chess player, and they used to chess gamble on the basis of this chess match. And the king of Kalinga, every time that Balaram would lose a bet, he would go like this. He would show his teeth, it said. He would show his teeth, like if you're trying to agitate someone who's been defeated, and you go, it's very rude. To say, and, you know, to do that with somebody like Balaram showed bad judgment anyway. But he was influenced by the king of Kalinga, and also due to his own enmity against Krishna for what? Because, you know, when, after he was released, he went and he wouldn't go back to his own kingdom. He established another place where he performed austerities, waiting for the day to somehow get revenge on Krishna for what he'd done. But in the end, he ended up insulting Balaram, and Balaram dispatched him. You know, he just got up from the match. And actually what had happened was, Balaram lost the first three bets with Rukmi. He lost the first three bets. It was first bet, I think it was 100 gold coins, then 1,000 gold coins, then 10,000 gold coins. And Balaram lost each time, and that's when the king of Kalinga started this grinning business. And then Balaram won, bet 100,000 gold coins and won. And then he bet 1,000,000 gold coins and won. And then the king of Kalinga and Rukmi started claiming that actually he'd cheated and that he hadn't really won. And they kept insisting that he hadn't won. Even a divine voice spoke from the sky and said, no, actually he did win. This is nonsense. You know, you're saying that he didn't win. He did win. But they kept insisting that he hadn't. So at that point, Balaram got up and with one blow of his club, he finished off Rukmi. So, but anyway, I'm just saying it was a little ironical here because he says, a relative should not be killed, even if his wrongdoing warrants capital punishment. So there's a little contradiction. Rather, he should be thrown out of the family. Since he has already been killed by his own sin, why kill him again? In other words, he'll be punished because he's committed the sinful act, or so many sinful acts in Rukmi's case. But why punish him? He's going to have to suffer so much anyway, so why kill him, you know, twice? So then he turns back to Rukmini again, Balaram. The code of sacred duty for warriors established by Lord Brahma enjoins that one may have to kill even his own brother. That is indeed a most dreadful law. Then he turns his attention back to Krishna. Blinded by conceit with their personal opulences, proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. So he's saying these are the motives for arrogant people. People who are blinded, how does he put it? Blinded by conceit with their personal opulences. So we sometimes see it that people that are very wealthy, they become very proud. They think, because I'm wealthy, I'm better than other people. I remember years ago there was a famous case where this lady who owned many hotels referred to people who paid taxes as little people. That's for the little people paying taxes. She didn't feel that she had to do it. So wealth can be very blinding. They're prepared to offend others, it says, for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. So we see this is a very prominent principle in human society. Then back to Rukmini. He says, your attitude is unfair. For like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical to all living beings. So you're trying to wish good on somebody who's just simply inimical and nasty. He says, and who have done evil to your true well-wishers. I'm obviously including himself and Krishna in the category of well-wishers. He says, they're trying to do us harm, and you feel sorry for them? People that are actually your well-wishers. Now remember, Rukmi was the one that stood in the way of her marrying Krishna in the first place. So how was he a well-wisher? He wasn't a well-wisher. He was just trying to please one of his friends. And look what friend he was trying to please, Shishupal, who hurled so many insults against Krishna. Of course, he also met his end at the Rajasuya Yajna. Krishna had agreed at the time of his birth to tolerate his insults, as I think it was up to 100. And he made it to 100 in that particular instance, and he was dispatched. So it says, this is again still Balaram speaking to Rukmini, the Supreme Lord's Maya makes men forget their real selves, and thus, taking the body for the self, they consider others to be friends, enemies, or neutral parties. Those who are bewildered perceive the one supreme soul who resides in all embodied beings as many, just as one may perceive the light in the sky or the sky itself as many. This material body, which has a beginning and an end, is composed of the physical elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. The body, imposed on the self by material ignorance, causes one to experience a cycle of birth and death. O intelligent lady, the soul never undergoes contact with or separation from insubstantial material objects. So that's the soul, unchanged. Because the soul is their very origin and illuminator. Thus the soul resembles the sun, which neither comes in contact with nor separates from the sense of sight and what is seen. So Balaram's speaking on a very, very philosophical level. Because really, Rukmini is behaving as though, or behaving as one who is bewildered on the material platform, bewildered by bodily sentiment for her brother. So he's preaching on this very philosophical level. He says, birth and other transformations are undergone by the body, but never by the self, just as change occurs for the moon's phases, but never for the moon. Though the new moon day may be called the moon's death. So it may appear that the moon has died or that the soul has vanished. But he says, as a sleeping person perceives himself, the objects of sense enjoyment and the fruits of his acts within the illusion of a dream, so one who is unintelligent undergoes material existence. So in other words, you're in a sleeping condition in the bodily concept of life. So this is like the illusion of a dream. Therefore, with transcendental knowledge, dispel the grief that is weakening and confounding your mind. So he's saying, seeing things transcendentally, dispel this grief that you're feeling. So jnana chakshus or shastra chakshus, by seeing through the eyes of scripture, one is able to dispel grief. So that's, we are enjoined to practice that ourselves. Try to see things philosophically, not emotionally necessarily. Please resume your natural mood, O princess of the pristine smile. Shukadeva Goswami said, thus enlightened by Lord Balaram, slender Rukmini forgot her depression and steadied her mind by spiritual intelligence. So I just wanted to read something. This is, you know, I don't know how many people read Krishna book these days, but you ought to, because it's Prabhupada's commentary on the 10th canto. It's the story, but it's also commentary. And sometimes the way he phrases things, although, of course, in the 10th canto, they were sticking very carefully to the actual Sanskrit. But Prabhupada, in commenting once on the Krishna book, he said, what is it? The Krishna book was called the Summary Study, I think, wasn't it? Summary Study. The Summary Study. He said, Summary Study means I can say whatever I like. So I just wanted to read the part of this conversation, the way he expresses it, which I think is more interesting, or at least more. This is from the. This is an old edition. This is before there was a BBT. This was ISKCON Press. And he elaborates this, the instructions of Balaram to Rukmini. If you want to read not only the instructions, but also the commentary on the instructions, it's in Krishna book. In chapter, 53. So, he gives all the same analogies. And then in the end, he concludes like this, and I like it better than the way they did it here, so that's why I'm reading it. He says, in this way, Sri Balaram instructed them in spiritual knowledge. Now, what does he mean by them? He means Rukmi, Krishna, and Rukmini. He addressed his sister-in-law thus, sweet smiling Rukmini, do not be aggrieved by false motives caused by ignorance. Due to false notions only, one becomes unhappy. So, I mean, you know, all these things are like sutras almost sometimes, because you could take that one phrase, due to false notions only, one becomes unhappy, and you could give quite a deep philosophical commentary on a statement like that. And if you think about it, it's true. Whenever analyze the next time you're unhappy. Why is it I'm unhappy? Because there's some sort of false notion has entered the mind. So that's actually the root cause of the unhappiness. Whatever that false notion might be, that's what's causing the unhappiness. Anyway, he says, sweet smiling Rukmini, do not be aggrieved by false motives caused by ignorance. Due to false notions only, one becomes unhappy. But this unhappiness is immediately removed by discussing the philosophy of actual life. So by contemplating the actual philosophy of life, sometimes, you know, devotees sometimes when they're preaching, they say about Krishna consciousness, they say, according to the philosophy. Like there's only this one philosophy. Of course, there are many philosophies, but there's one. And in one sense, it's correct, but anyway, he says the philosophy of actual life, you can remove that unhappiness by discussing this philosophy. He says, be happy on that platform only. Be happy on that platform only. So such nice advice given by Lord Balaram. So now, I want to read something else. What time does this end? 9 o'clock, is that right? Is 9 o'clock the deadline? Yeah. So if you're tired, if you want to get up and stretch, chant a few mantras, that's okay. And I'll try to leave a little time for questions if there are any. This is from the Chaitanya Bhagavat. Going back to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu now about his marriage. Of marriage with Lakshmi. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes a nice purport about that marriage of Lord Chaitanya with Lakshmi, who is actually Rukmini, who is actually Janaki, the goddess of fortune. He writes, the verse is, Ye sunaye prabhura vivaha punya katha, tahara sangsara bhanda na haya sarvata. Whoever hears these auspicious topics of the Lord's marriage is never entangled in worldly life. So it's an interesting benediction, isn't it? Because usually if you think about, oh, let's hear all about somebody's late, you know, marriage. Well, you don't really think of that as a liberating sort of thing. You know, hearing about somebody's marriage, oh, yeah, they had this kind of dress on and they had this kind of prasadam, or, you know, what? There's nothing particularly liberating about any of that ordinarily. But here it says, whoever hears about the Lord's marriage is never entangled in worldly life. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments on this as follows. In this material world, people become joyful by hearing about the marriage of a boy and a girl. Encouraged by such topics, the conditioned souls become eager to face the miseries of material bondage. Yeah. people think, let's get married and then I can face anything. Right. Well, you'll have to face everything anyway, but it says they become, the thing is, a lot of times in the writings of Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they're very sarcastic. I mean, they're very, their humor is very obvious in this. He's saying they become enthused, they become eager to face the miseries. I mean, that's pretty funny. To face the miseries of material bondage. Oh, yeah, let's. It reminds me of a line from a film once where these persons who didn't want to get married decide they're going to get married after all. And he says, I thought you didn't want to complicate your life. He says, no, I'm ready. I want to complicate the hell out of my life. So it's definitely a complication, but people are very eager. But anyway, to go on, this is Bhaktisiddhanta again. But the topics related with the marriage of Sriman Mahaprabhu, who is the controller of Maya, are not like this. This pastime of the Lord is meant to demonstrate the uselessness of material existence. A living entity who is attached to material enjoyment considers the marriage of a mundane boy and girl to be the ideal example of sense gratification. And if he considers the spiritual pastimes of the Supreme Lord's marriage as similar to the conditioned soul's sense gratificatory activities, which are apparently sweet but ultimately poison, he doesn't mince words too much, Bhaktisiddhanta. He says it's apparently sweet but ultimately poison. This is the good news. There's one reference to this. On a morning walk in Dallas once, Prabhupada, they were talking about this. They were walking around this area called White Rock Lake, and there was a famous millionaire that lived there, H.L. Hunt, who had made his fortune in the oil business. So they said, Prabhupada, we tried to see him, but he wouldn't see us. And Prabhupada said, so when death comes, will he also say he cannot see you? He said, he may say, but death will come and do his business anyway. So then he raised the question to the devotees, so if you were able to see him, what would you have said? So the devotees offered different suggestions about what they would say something about the school, would say something about your books. And Prabhupada said, no. He said, you should tell him that you have made so much money by exploiting the earth for oil. He said, now, so you have actually stolen the property of the Lord. He said, so when death comes, you will be severely punished. He said, this is the good news we have brought you. And so they were saying, but Prabhupada, if we speak like that to him, he'll become very angry. And Prabhupada said, angry? If I shake my stick at a dog, he will also become angry. He said, you have to learn how to speak to this class of men. So the devotees were sort of astonished that that was Prabhupada's formula for talking to this wealthy industrialist, to tell him that he's, you know, going to suffer terribly at the point of death if he doesn't give up his nonsense. So anyway, here Bhaktisiddhanta, I know I'm going off a little bit here, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, if you compare the Lord's marriage to those of an ordinary person whose activities are apparently sweet but ultimately poison, he will certainly be entangled in the bondage of material existence. But the Supreme Lord is the only object of all enjoyment, and the servants, maidservants, and wonderful ingredients of service, which are all under his control, cannot produce such inauspiciousness. Wherever the happiness of the Lord is present, the sense gratification of the living entities cannot remain. In this regard, one should discuss auspicious nectarian statements, such as the following verses from Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhakti Pareshanu Bhavo Viraktir Anyatra Chai Shatrika Eka Kalaha. This is a verse from the 11th canto that Prabhupada often cited, these lines. Devotion, and it means devotion, direct experience of the Supreme Lord, and detachment from other things. These three occur simultaneously. So he said you should study this verse. And then he quotes this other verse from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Iha yasya harer dasye. This is a famous verse. And it means a person acting in the service of Krishna with his body, mind, intelligence, and words is a liberated person even within the material world, although he may engage in many apparently material activities. So, I should probably stop there, but I can't resist. This verse that I cited, it's such a great verse, and it's elaborately discussed in the 11th canto. And the meaning of the verse is devotion, direct experience of the Supreme Lord, and detachment from other things. These three occur simultaneously for one who has taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the same way that pleasure, nourishment, and relief from hunger come simultaneously and increasingly with each bite for a person engaged in eating. So this verse is often used by Prabhupada to explain the experiential nature of Krishna consciousness. That these three things should occur if you've actually taken shelter of the Supreme Lord. Experience of detachment, devotion, direct experience of the Lord, and detachment from everything else. So there's a purport, and most of this comes from the writings of Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So it's not too long. I'm just going to quickly read through it, and then I'll open it up if there's any questions. So Srila Jiva Goswami has explained this analogy as follows. Bhakti, or devotion, may be compared to tushti, satisfaction, because they both take the form of pleasure. Pareshanu bhava, experience of the Supreme Lord, and pushti, nourishment, are analogous because both sustain one's life. Finally, virakti, detachment, and shuddhapaya, cessation of hunger, may be compared because both free one from further hankering so that one may experience shanti, or peace. A person who is eating not only becomes uninterested in other activities. Maybe that's not true of universally true, but I know at least in my case, I don't care about anything else when I'm taking prasadam. Not only becomes uninterested in other activities, but increasingly becomes uninterested in the food itself, according to his satisfaction. On the other hand, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, although one who is experiencing the blissful personality of Godhead Krishna becomes uninterested in anything other than Krishna, his attachment to Krishna increases at every moment. Therefore, it is to be understood that the transcendental beauty and qualities of the Supreme Lord are not material, since one never becomes satiated by relishing the bliss of the Supreme Lord. Anyway, it's late now. I think I'm going to stop there. But there's a very nice discussion of this verse and its relationship. And one thing that Prabhupada brings out in his purports about this verse is that you can judge your own advancement by how much you are actually detached from sense gratification. So if you want to know, am I getting anywhere, you can just you can just measure your taste for serving Krishna against your desire for sense enjoyment, then you'll have a pretty good idea. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments?